Special Committee on Energy to order. It's 10:20 on Tuesday, April 4th. Members present are Vice Chair Sponholz, Representative Johnston, Representative Westlake, myself, Chair Wall. Today we have a presentation from Craig Johnston from Lockheed Martin entitled Hybrid Airships Opening New Frontiers. He's the Director of Aeronautic Strategy and Business Development at Lockheed Martin Skunk Works Division. I'm sure he'll tell us why it's called Skunk Works. Also, we have calling in a little bit later from the state DOT, Nick Mastrodacasa, and who's worked on airships specifically in Alaska and probably has spoken with our presenter today. And we have some cool stuff coming ahead, so I figured this was applicable to energy. And Mr. Johnston, if you could put yourself on the record and give your presentation, we'd be thrilled.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairman. First of all, thank you for the invitation to come up here. It's my first trip to Alaska. My wife was actually born in Alaska but left as an infant, so she was very jealous that I got back before she did on that. And also, thank you for the wonderful weather. I noted yesterday when I landed that it was about the same temperature in Juneau as it was in Southern California when I left yesterday morning, albeit a little bit earlier. But so your lows and our highs are a little bit out of sync there. But I'd like to start out first with just a short little thing about Lockheed Martin, about the company I'm with. We're a company that's about 100 years old, that in the broad scheme of things is a conglomeration of many aerospace companies, notably the Lockheed Corporation and Glenn L. Martin, probably the oldest of the aerospace companies are out there. So 100 years, about 100,000 employees worldwide, largely very technical scientists, engineers, technicians. We have people or products in just about every state in the union, and in 80 countries, at least 80 countries worldwide, primarily in the defense and military sectors, but we're increasingly going into the civil and commercial sectors, and so that's some of the stuff that we're talking about today. I'm from the Skunk Works Division, which we've been around for about 75 years now. History has been primarily in aviation, and so many of the projects that we did have been trying to drive at urgent national needs. So back in World War II, our first product was the introduction of the jet fighter to the United States Army Air Corps. So we had the first operational jet fighter back in 1943. So that's where we drive our earliest history.
What plane was that, just out of curiosity?
The XP-80. So it was called the Lulu Bell, which ultimately became the Shooting Star and went into over 7,000 vehicles that were actually built on that model.
I'd also like to recognize Representative Johnston is here.
Notably also many of the projects that we've done that many people know about, from the secrecy of the Skunk Works, which were the early spy planes, the U-2, the SR-71, the Stealth Fighter, and even up to lately we were the developers and original designers of what became the F-35, the Joint Strike Fighter. So we have a long history of innovation. I'd also like for this committee to briefly highlight some things that are going on in the corporation relative to energy. It's a relatively new line of business for the corporation. About 2 years ago, we stood up a specific business area called Lockheed Martin Energy as a business area. They're focused in five areas. Energy management, which really involves a lot of complex systems engineering, which is what we do in the aerospace sector very well. Energy storage and nuclear systems. The focus there is on safety and controls. Again, a very critical and intense thing. But also some exciting things going on in sustainable energy, both tidal energy and bioenergy sorts of things. So I would encourage you, although I'm not going to speak to those, to this specific committee, those are components that are within our corporation. Also, although not part of my topic today, the Skunk Works team is actually doing some pretty innovative research in advanced energy means also. That we have wind-to-power conversion going on with Massachusetts Institute of Technology, putting on the outsides of buildings to actually generate energy in a very aesthetic way. A very exciting project that we've got going on with Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We also are trying to capitalize on energy infrastructure inspection. So think about the long-winded infrastructure, whether it be pipelines, power lines, et cetera. Can we use our advanced technology and airborne platforms to actually provide surveying and inspection of those critical infrastructure things? And do we have the sensors that can tell, is a pipeline leaking in remote areas, not only in Alaska, but worldwide? And so that's kind of a new area that the Skunk Works is looking into, going into. And then we've got some really exciting things going on. Advanced plasma research that was designed for other areas, but one of the things we're looking at is potentially unlocking the power, if you will, of fusion energy. And so you may have seen a couple of years ago that Lockheed announced that the Skunk Works were working on very compact fusion reactors. I can tell you that that research continues, and we're excited that that we may someday unlock the potential for some very revolutionary power kind of capabilities. So those are things that are not necessarily what I'm going to talk about today.
Representative Westlake.
Yes, through the chair, and I've had the pleasure of meeting a couple of your co-workers up there in Kotzebue, and I wanted to inform you that your energy division is doing wonderfully well. We're working closely with them in Kotzebue above the Arctic Circle, so we can't thank you folks enough. It's really good working with you guys.
So what I am here today to talk about is hybrid airships, and airships specifically, and I titled this as Opening New Frontiers. You guys are on the frontier still. You guys, the Alaskans, we still look fondly at that, but want to recognize that this may bring even new efforts to the frontiers that are out here. Two specific things on this first slide is one, the Lockheed Martin brand, but one of the other things that you may see is the brand of Hybrid Enterprises. One of the things that we have done as part of our initiative to enter into the commercial market spaces, we've actually partnered up with people who are more experienced in the commercial fields, and specifically some of the things that we're not necessarily the world's best at in terms of what's going on. So you'll see that typically in some of the nomenclature that's out there publicly. There we go. So let's start with why airships. Airships have been around for a long time, and I put up two kind of antique representations of those. One, probably the most significant, is the ship. So if you think about airship, ship is the most important term in that. And the reason for that is ships provide essentially a very efficient way of carrying things because of the buoyancy that a ship naturally has. Ships also then only take a small amount of energy, and in fact, in this case, wind energy, free energy, to move them. So you get the lift for free, and you get the propulsion to push it forward for very low cost. Okay, so that's a very intriguing way, which is the reason that ships have been around for years, moving cargo around the world. The problem is they're restricted to the water. So then you introduce the notion of air, and the fact that if I go to the air environment, if I can create the same buoyancy through a gas, whether it be heated air, the hot air balloon, or helium or hydrogen, that you get that free lift, if you will. But the problem here is that you tend not to have the controllability that you have in other places. And so certainly some old renditions would be challenged by, you know, how do you actually move and control these things that are generally lighter than air. So you think about that hot air balloon that you can push around. So the real secret is, how do you get the best of both those modes, both the ship and the air? And I would almost say those terms backwards, but we've already said airships. But if you think about it first and foremost as a ship-like operation, it would be much closer to what really is the power of the system. Also, there are a number of types of airships. The most recognizable probably are the blimps, which generally have no rigid structure inside. They rely on a lighter-than-air gas. For the last 50 years, that's always been helium. There is no longer hydrogen used inside of the airships because of the hazardous nature of those. But helium, which is an inert gas, can't burn, is actually lighter than air and is used inside the blimps. So if, in Southern California, certainly we're very used to seeing the Goodyear blimps that are out there. Those form the simplest of the airships as non-rigid ones. The semi-rigid off to the right is actually, as the airships get larger and as you start to try and separate out some of the components, where the propulsion system, instead of all hanging on that central gondola, is actually dispersed out to other parts of the structure, is another approach at doing that. The airship shown there is actually the Norge. That has a little bit of Alaska history to it. That was an airship that launched in the 20s with an intention of flying over the North Pole and dropping flags with the nations. Made a rather eventful landing in the Alaskan Arctic and was disassembled and never flown again. So although a challenging thing, I will say, interestingly, we had people come back to us and say we'd like to re-commemorate those journeys, and one of the things that we kind of convinced them of, it's not nearly as exciting today with the technology because it's not nearly the big risk that they took back in the 20s in terms of overflight of the Arctic. The last form there is the rigid airships. The most notably there are the very large airships of the 20s and 30s. This one, the Graf Zeppelins, that were massive airships with aluminum structures underneath. A little bit later, I'm going to show you some concepts of very large airships that we've been looking at. But that airship itself was 900 feet long, so it was a very massive airship that was used rigid structure primarily because it starts to become economical as you get to very large sizes. So airships capable of transiting the ocean with relatively small payloads, number of passengers that are involved. On your table, I've got pictures of other concepts and prototypes that kind of represent the modern age of thought. I haven't included them in this one because I don't have copyright permission on the actual images that are used, but I can assure you that if you look at that website, www.airshipassociation.org, you can get a lot of information on those. But I'd just like to kind of highlight kind of the other areas that have been looked at in terms of concepts and prototypes. On the left side, noted by the Boeing and Piasecki things, is looking at how do I capitalize on the power of a helicopter sort of approach and then put some lighter than air balloon technology that allows me to augment the lift that I would normally receive from a heavy lift helicopter. And so you see the two concepts there that look like a bunch of helicopters that are kind of strapped together with a large balloon. They've been looked at in the past. They have some applications for areas where helicopters pay off real well, but economically I think they're challenged a little bit for, you know, if those will really actually pay off. The two on the top, Aeroscraft and Varialift, are similar concepts that are looking at mechanisms whereby they control their buoyancy by compression of the lighter-than-air gas, helium in this case. One of the challenges with airships is controlling the buoyancy so that you can go up and down. And so one way you can do that is to actually compress the helium gas to allow you to go down and reduce the volume of helium that's involved. It's a concept that the Aeroscraft is probably furthest along in looking into. Again, we look at it and go, it's an interesting way of controlling it, but can be rather expensive in terms of the technology that goes into it. Ross Aero Systems is a Russian company. They don't have a lot of information. It appears to be somewhat of a combination of rigid airships and hybrid airships, trying to use a little bit of aerodynamics to it. And then probably the one that's significantly furthest along is the Hybrid Air Vehicles, a company in the United Kingdom. They received a contract through the Army about 4 years ago to build an airship for surveillance and reconnaissance. So think of it as a unmanned platform that could launch to about 20,000 feet and persist over the battlefield looking having sensors. That company in the UK has come back and is trying to resurrect that technology and put it forward for use in cargo or other mechanisms.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say the Army, do you mean the our Army or yes. Their Army or in combination there? Okay.
It was the United States Army through the contractor Northrop Grumman was the U.S. Contractor on it. They hired the U.K. company to help them develop the airship for it. But it was the United States Army.
Thank you.
So, here's our.
That of your total lift comes from buoyant helium. The remaining 20% comes from aerodynamic lift, generated by the innovative trilobe envelope design. By blending aerodynamic lift with buoyant lift, hybrid airships can achieve the operating efficiencies of traditional airships while retaining the reliable ground handling characteristics of fixed-wing aircraft.
So that's some of the magic that we think of. So when we say hybrid airships, what do we mean? I mentioned on the first slide that one of the key elements is the buoyant lift, the lift that's provided by the helium gas. The beauty of that is it's always on, so it's there for free. It's our version of anti-gravity. The challenge of that is it's always on, and you can't turn it off. And so there are concepts, notably the ones that use compression, that try to compress that gas to help turn the helium lift off. But we've got another way of doing that. And that involves the use of aerodynamics in addition to that. So we don't provide like a traditional blimp where all the lift basically comes from the buoyant gas. We combine that with the aerodynamic lift that provides us that extra piece. That is very important when you get to a ship that's trying to be operable. And that means that it doesn't just want to float away, but it actually has to have the forward aerodynamic lift to do that. It also provides it a very strong robustness against the environmental conditions, because what you can do, like an airplane, is you can adjust the amount of lift that you get by the angle of attack that you fly at. So if you increase the angle of attack, you can increase the amount of lift that comes from the aerodynamics. Nominally, we fly with about 20% of the lift provided by the aerodynamics. But if you, as an example, would take on a little bit of extra weight, let's say that it's raining, and the airship will collect a little bit of water weight, if you will, you would simply just increase the angle of attack to provide you that robustness against it. Likewise, if you had snow or something like that while in flight, you can simply adjust the angle of attack. Unlike a traditional airship, where that would just slowly bring you down because it can't adjust to the additional lift.
Excuse me. Is snow and ice, is that a huge concern? Is that something you guys can deal with?
Especially ice, you know, I guess.
Yeah, so there are two elements there. One is on the ground and one is in flight. And it's a it's an issue that we are very aware of. It is asked every time we present. And so it's not one that's a new question for us. But let me talk about on the ground first. That one of the things that, as a ship, one of the things we look at is you try and use predictive capabilities to decide where is the safest place to be in an impending storm. So if I have an idea that there is a massive snowstorm coming, which modern weather prediction allows us to do it, the most probable thing that you would do from an economic and safety standpoint is go ahead and just launch the airship and leave port, if you will, so that you're not there when the 2 feet of snow is going to come down. It's going to present a bigger challenge on the ground than it would be in flight. And so once you present a blowing, if you will, 60 knots of airspeed, the accumulation of snow is not likely to happen in flight. So if you had a massive snow event that you could predict, you would simply just leave the port and go airborne. Ice is a little bit different, but it's different from normal aviation sense. In normal aviation sense, the actual accumulation of ice on the surface presents a safety hazard in that it provides disruption to the airflow over the airfoil. And so for normal aviation, it's a very, not dangerous, but remarkable thing that you have to avoid in terms of the icing. On an airship, it's not that at all. For an airship, the issue is the ice can create weight. It doesn't disrupt the airflow, but it can add to the weight of the system. And so again, if you're on the ground, you would probably decide if I have a massive icing event to depart. If I were in flight and encountered that massive icing event, then just like normal aviation, what I do is get out of that event, whether that be ascend, descend, or the other. So it is something that we look at. There are mitigation factors both in flight and on the ground in terms of how we have that robust weather ability.
Yes, and through the chair. So I'm looking at this, and the 20% from aerodynamic, and for lack of a better term, is there a stall speed on this? When do you quit providing the lift over there when you're talking the aerodynamics?
So yes, you can achieve the notion of a stall, but not in the normal sense that you would see from a normal fixed-wing aircraft. Although we're a lifting shape, we're a very inefficient lifting shape, so you would see more of a, it just isn't going to go up anymore. Mm-hmm. And if you got to the point where, let's say that for whatever reason, you had increasing lift requirements, whether it be additional weight or loss of something else, what would end up happening is you would slowly come down. Okay. So one of the safety features of this system is the fact that nothing happens very quickly. And that in fact, when problems happen, the airship, because 80% of the lift is still there. So imagine an airplane where, you know, even if everything else went away, you're still kind of a slow parachute coming down. And so one of the things that we've studied in detail is what happens with engine loss. And even if you lost all four engines, you could no longer, if you had a certain weight state, you could no longer maintain forward flight, and you would slowly descend. Interesting, our pilots in the initial things were given the opportunity to actually wear parachutes, and they said, well, wait a minute. The parachutes will hit the ground before the airship hits the ground, so I think I'll just stay in the airship. Because it inherently doesn't happen very quickly, because again, we can't shut that off.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, okay, so I used to have hot air balloons, so it's a little different. I mean, it's a little uncontrolled up there, but you get up in the, you try to catch the currents, obviously, in the the loan. So when you're talking about the lift and you're talking about the, you know, the your whatever ailerons or whatever you have there, so I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, are your pilots going to be like studying the air currents and then, like, you know, or your, you know, your, whether your people or otherwise, do you try to get in the current and then propel the beyond the speed at whatever current you are, so it's in, it's not static in the air, I guess.
Right.
So it's going faster, so you have something that's propelling it forward, I guess, right?
Right.
And then, so it's not like, is it like typical pilot thing where you say, I'm going to go from A to B, or are you trying to, is there a little more to it, I guess? I was just going to say
that. And actually, if I go to the next slide, maybe that will go. Is some of the other features of it. So you saw kind of the hybrid lift, the various forms that are on there. Not insignificant was one of the pieces that I didn't talk a lot about, which was the direct lift from the propulsion system. The LMH-1, which is the first airship that we're going to build, actually has four propulsion systems attached on the outside of the vehicle. Importantly there, we are a non-rigid structure, and so we actually use the pressure inside to provide a stiff enough surface to where we can actually attach the propulsion systems directly on the outside. That typically in the past was a hallmark of a semi-rigid airship, but the advances in materials allow us to do that actually in a non-rigid sense. Those propulsion systems are the things that actually can give us both the forward flight, so that if we're trying to push forward just under direct power, at certain speeds the aerodynamic surfaces, the tails, provide some of the control. But you also have the sophistication of the flight control system that allows the pilot to say very simply kind of two different factors. One is my speed stick. It simply commands how fast I want to go from -3 miles an hour, -3 knots to 70 knots. And all the pilot is doing is saying how fast I want to go. In a normal airplane, you're controlling the power, which then through the magic of aerodynamics ultimately results in an equation that solves for the speed that you're going to get. In this case, all he's doing is saying how fast. So if he says go zero, the airship will come to a stop. At some weight states, you can just sit there at zero speed. You can even back it up, if you will. Okay. So part of it is the commanding of speed. The other is a command of where do you want to go. And the where do you want to go is essentially two simple things. One is go down, so you push the stick forward and the airship will descend. You pull it back, the airship goes up. So combination of how fast and up and down. And then you have the ability to say turn left 30 degrees, turn right 30 degrees. And so a very simple command structure, but a very sophisticated flight control system, because it's controlling many things, including the ability to sense the fact that there's air currents on the airship, so that when it says, okay, I told it to turn 30 degrees right, but I've got a strong crosswind that's fighting that, the airship flight control system is smart enough to say, okay, if you want to do that and maintain 30 knots, then I have to increase the power to my engines to be able to go do that. So it's a very simple for the pilot to do, but a very sophisticated set of flight control systems that are actually doing that. And to your other question, one of the things as you look at actual deployment of this, one of the things is the planning for the fact that there are winds. And so much like the ships that will plan for the currents and the trades that go on, much like that in this sort of thing where you would actually be able to decide, and the ship is smart enough to figure out how to take the most economic pathway to get where it needs to go.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you for the chair. And I noticed that you have this onboard weather prediction and route planning. Are you using satellite imaging for that and using all the connectivity that's required for that? Thank you.
So that's one of the keys that in the airships of old, when they took off from Norway and tried to fly over the North Pole, they had no idea what they were going to see.
Yeah.
And today, the beauty of real-time weather, you know, worldwide, you have the ability to get very detailed prediction of what you would expect. The other piece that is very significant is the air cushion landing system. That one of the things to be operable in remote areas was a system that gave you robustness against all sorts of landing and takeoff surfaces. So our air cushion landing system is actually based on hovercraft technology. You probably have the picture of all that stuff blowing out from the bottom of hovercrafts. That's because they're a relatively dense system. We're a relatively non-dense system, so it doesn't take much pressure over a very small area to actually levitate above on a cushion of air that allows us to actually move over almost any ground feature without actually even touching it. So sensitive tundra, you're floating a couple of inches above the tundra. Sand, rock, water, all these sorts of things give you the ability to essentially move over the top of that with anything that's shorter than about a foot that the airship just simply goes over the top of. So you take off and land without any of the infrastructure requirements.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I'm kind of fascinated with that because, so you've got your 20% aerodynamic aspect of this, but then you're also sort of hovering. Is the aerodynamic still part of it, or are you then just using your helium, your flotation, and your engines?
So once you come in contact with the ground, your aerodynamics are a very small component.
Right.
Because you're moving at very low speeds, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of it is just holding the vehicle up off the ground through these air cushion landing systems until you get to the point where you say, and this is important, where you say, okay, now I want to unload, in which case I turn the fans around, and now I simply pull myself onto the surface. And so I, in a sense, the technical term is suck myself down to the ground to do that. And that gives me additional friction so that when I come time to unload cargo, I don't have an airship that's moving around, which is a problem if you looked at a traditional airship, which is they are always just weather vaning into the wind. This one, you would park it into the prevailing wind and then engage the suction motor.
So it's more of a suction as opposed to...
Yeah. It's not trying to hold it from lifting off.
Right.
It's basically just providing additional friction on the surface. Because if you will, the air hockey table, when you turn the air on, how slick it is, but you turn it off, and all of a sudden the friction goes away. It's similar to that sort of concept in terms of this.
Thank you.
Representative Westlake.
Yes, and through the chair. It's a nice segue into what Representative Johnston said. I'm looking at this from the village standpoint, where I come from. I've got four villages now where you can't get barges anymore. Now, anchoring something over, say I need to deliver 300,000 gallons of fuel over to a village, is there a way you can anchor on top and just gravity feed this thing? I'm just looking at applications over here. I mean, the transference of right from the vehicle right over to the tanks, is there a way you can anchor that where moving over, I know that the vectoring is there, but trying to keep it on.
So a typical operation, if it's a fuel load operation,
yes.
If I'm going to be a tanker,
yes.
The operation would be, right now you could either use some onboard, what we call auxiliary tanks, that allow us to always fly at the maximum economic, which is you want to fly an airplane always full.
Yes.
Okay, that gives you the lowest cost per pound.
Yes.
So if I had cargo, if I had 1,000 pounds of groceries that I was bringing in, but I wanted to fill up the rest of the airship capability, 37,000 pounds, I could put 37,000 pounds of fuel on board, fly it to the village, as I would decide that I have to offload it. I do have to manage my weight state.
Okay.
So if I'm going to go back, if there's nothing to bring back with me, so I'm going to go back light, what I would do is the first thing that would happen is I would add water to my water ballast system. So I would pump about 3,000 to 4,000 gallons of water on board. So for concept, that's one of the smaller water trucks.
Mm-hmm.
That ensures that my vehicle always stays in a state of heaviness. I would then likely offload the fuel by just pumping it direct onto village fuel tanks, move the groceries on. If I didn't have anything else to go back, I would put enough ballast on to where I'm safe to just simply return back. But if there's any weight that would want to go back to the next spot, I would just simply put that on and offload that requisite amount of water ballast. But that would be the typical operation, would be pump it into those auxiliary tanks and then pump it off once I got to the remote site. And you could set up a tempo to where instead of thinking about massing a tremendous amount like you do in a barge,
that
you could almost have the weekly fuel run that shows up year-round, because it's, again, not driven by a lot of the environmentals that are there.
Thank you.
So the interior layout, designed for cargo, the cargo bay capable of 20 metric tons of cargo capability, and depending on other states, you can get up to 47,000 pounds of cargo on board, is the back end of the airship. It's 10 feet by 10 feet by 60 feet. So to give you a sense, that's about the size of the overland tractor trailers. They're typically 10 feet by 8 feet by about 53 feet is kind of a large one, so we're slightly larger than that, slightly wide. You can see the ballast and cargo fuel saddle tanks. Those are the ones I was just talking about that reside both as a mechanism to put the water ballast on, but also give you the ability to put extra fuel on board. The cargo bay in the back is separated by a series of accommodation bays that put the pilot and the crew station out front. That's really all free space. One of the things that's unique about the airship is it doesn't really see much penalty for the fact that you have cargo in the back and people in the front, because I've separated those two pieces. And so the people fly for free. Unlike most cargo operations, you either people or cargo, but there's usually a point on that. The standard configuration has two pilots. That's an FAA requirement. The system is capable probably of completely autonomous operation, but the FAA currently says, I want to have two pilots on board. Standard configuration is eight seats, eight business class seats, but we can accommodate up to 19 passengers total. That's an FAA restriction. Beyond 19 passengers, you have to have additional safety features.
Representative Westlake.
You brought up something that's been bugging me. I've been wondering about the FAA over there. So hearing this, so you're basically a Part 135?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
No, we're actually a hybrid.
Okay, yeah.
So we actually have a whole new type certification.
Okay.
And then we'll work with the operators to receive their, there's an aircraft certification, there's an operator certification, and we're kind of in between the two because of the operations. We're working with the FAA to work towards new pilot rules because of the degree of autonomy that's possible in modern systems. And then in some of the areas where we deploy, you're truly in areas where it is the dull part of thing. And so one of the things with Transport Canada is leaning out kind of forward going, yeah, we could envision pilotless cargo airships servicing remote areas.
Yeah. And if I may follow up.
Yep.
So, good. If you're talking to the FAA, please remind them that a lot of places here in Alaska don't have the automatic weather services that they require. So some of these regulations would exclude you just because it works down in the lower 48. It doesn't here. Just remind them for us. Thank you.
So I have a question. How much, so you say you know, maybe you're leaning towards pilotless at some point, and if the FAA would allow it. What does that do to your cost? Is that a big component of having two pilots? And I would imagine if it's pilotless, you're probably not carrying passengers, or is that not necessarily true? I guess that remains to be seen.
Remains to be seen. The FAA's primary concern is safety. Safety of the people on board and safety of people on the ground. And so we're all on board with that. Whether or not the flying public is ready to get on board an airplane where there's no pilot up front, I suspect that's probably a little bit further away. But I do also believe that with the advancements with autonomous cars and things like that, that we will see that there becomes a comfort level that says, okay, you got in a cab that didn't have a cabbie up front. Are you ready to get in the same sort of thing? Now, if you're in a 600-mile-an-hour jet, your calculus is slightly different in terms of your willingness to get on board. But if you're in a 60-knot fluffy airship, you might be a little bit more in the I'm willing to take that. That feels a lot more like my autonomous cab ride than, you know.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just trying to envision this a little bit, and I know a little bit about airspace, and so, but, I mean, you must be, you can't put a faster plane behind a slower plane, and altitudes, obviously there's other routes where airliners are flying in, which, you know, they're probably, I mean, I'm assuming you could go through them, but you don't want to hang out in them too long.
Right.
Is there going to need to be any kind of airspace changes, or can you work within what you have and just fly at different levels?
In general, it works within the system we have. One of the things that's important to recognize is that we're an unpressurized system, so our maximum altitude is 10,000 feet. Our normal operating altitude is about 1,500 to 2,500 feet above ground level.
Okay.
So we're not up with the airliners in general.
Mm-hmm.
We're operating significantly below the airliners, so it's not really a question of that. Also, in most of the operations that we envision, we also stay away from the airports.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about a hybrid airship port, your first thought was it's close to an airport. Well, no, it's not. That what we would build is an airship port that is away from all those fast-flying, pointy-looking things and actually go to a system whereby the airspace is largely controlled by the operations of these relatively slow things. Think about general aviation. We're flying at those sorts of speeds, but much larger. We're about a 300-foot-long vehicle. So you'd stay away from most airports and make your operations and set up your port operations away from the airports. But from an altitude standpoint, we're flying kind of not in the same areas where a lot of the other traffic is at. Certainly not the high-speed traffic, if that helps.
Thank you.
So one of the things that we did was create a video to highlight kind of what it looks like inside the business end of our hybrid airship. So let me...
When you've got a big job, large equipment, people to support, and no roads to get there, there's only one solution. The safe, simple, and sustainable answer, the Lockheed Martin Hybrid Airship. Engineered to provide the most cost-effective solution. The rugged cargo bay transports massive loads, such as fully assembled heavy equipment. Hybrid airships provide affordable transport and easy loading in areas not accessible by today's traditional methods. While performance, utility, and efficiency are key, so are the safety and comfort of crew.
So that's a 19-passenger variant.
For your most valuable cargo, the spacious cabin provides first-class accommodations for the long haul. Intuitive design and advanced flight controls will make your journey safe and comfortable. They say the road less traveled makes all the difference. But why not just leave the road behind? Hybrid airships by Lockheed Martin. No roads, no problem.
So we built that mock-up about a year ago, and we call it the hybrid experience. I can tell you that when you walk in, we put it in the middle of Alaska out in the Ambler region as a specific mechanism to say, okay, we're going to put it in its environment. So we've got a full 360-degree panorama of the region. We even turn the air conditioning up just a little bit so that it feels like a refreshing blast of cool air in the normal desert heat. But we're excited to give kind of a notion of what that airship looks like. So it's a very large thing, and with a cabin space that I mentioned earlier, the explorers that wanted to recreate the adventure of going to the North Pole, when they looked at it and said, well, that's nicer than most motorhomes. So it's not that big a deal at this point in terms of what's going on.
Representative Johnson.
Did you say this is semi-rigid or?
No, it's non-rigid.
Non-rigid. So, like, is it carbon Kevlar? What are you using for your threshold?
Lightweight fabric that we call, I'll think about it in a second here. But it's a Kevlar-like material that is also got impervious to the hydrogen stuff. So it becomes very strong, very lightweight, which allows us to pressurize with not a lot of pressure. But for structure, if you can put little pressure against large areas, you get a lot of strength. And so the tri-lobe hull design actually takes all the load of the gondola that we just saw in the video and suspends that through curtains that are hanging inside of the airship. So we distribute all that load across the entire upper surface of the thing to provide very low cost and supportable structure. There's nothing on the inside. One of the things that's remarkable about the airship is you go up to it and you like to say it's like a big bouncy house. So there's nothing on the inside. Everything is on the outside of our airship.
Thank you.
So the concept we've had for quite a while. What we did back 10 years ago was to say, okay, how can we convince ourselves and others that all this stuff really works? And so we built the P-791, the vehicle that you see on the far left there, as a technology demonstrator. That is the smallest airship that we could build that demonstrated all the requisite technologies that were involved. So the tri-lobe hull design, the digital flight control, the fully automated flight control system, and most importantly, probably the air cushion landing system to prove that we could make this thing an operable system. It was designed to carry two pilots and a tank of gas, so it was not a cargo vehicle. But as you see, it was still a fairly large vehicle. It was 120 feet long and flew at about 40 knots. And I'll show you some video here in a minute that shows how that operated.
Representative Chair, and so when you're talking the terms, you're talking long terms. You're talking metric terms, I get it. Thank you.
So, interestingly, if we go to the far right, that the journey that we actually started more than 20 years ago was looking at a massive airship that was capable of carrying 1 million pounds of cargo. And that's where, in partnership with some big freight companies that you're probably aware of, is where we actually started. That's the sweet spot, is if you can get to, think of it, a large container ship size, a small container ship, honestly, but it, ability to do that in the air. The problem is that that vehicle is massively large, and in fact, about the size of the Rose Bowl, if you're from Southern California or Texas State, depending on where you're at, but a very large thing. And the ability to take on the risk of doing that in a first instantiation was just a bridge too far, literally. And so we backed up to, what's the smallest sized airship that makes economic sense? And the 22-ton vehicle is actually very good, especially in remote markets, because much of the cargo that's out there is designed to go either in a truck or in a C-130, and so you've kind of packaged it into that size. And so this becomes a ready market for something that is ready to go. You see it most likely in remote areas. You wouldn't see this as that large container ship that's going to haul packages within the lower 48 or in areas with dedicated infrastructure. So it was very much a sweet spot. And so that's our first introduction, the LMH1. We look at that as a remote operating vehicle. It really is targeted after operations that you would otherwise conceive of doing with a heavy lift helicopter. In terms of some of the range. And so it's much lower cost than that. It becomes comparable in cost with other forms of transportation in remote areas. And depending on the situations, that's where we look at it. We do have plans to jump from 20 tons to the 90-ton sort of area. That has a much larger market. It's a relatively small step up. You can see that you go from about a 300-foot-long vehicle to about a 400-foot-long vehicle. The challenge with that for us is it does take new infrastructure in terms of manufacturing, because there aren't any hangars and manufacturing areas anywhere in the world that really are set up to build something that large. There are some of the older hangars that exist, but quite frankly, they need to be just put in the museums.
Representative Westlake. And through the chair, I'm going to go back to the aerodynamic, because you just brought up an interesting point. And I'm thinking of situations where we could use something like that. Do downdrafts play a significant, or are they a factor on airships like this?
Not a significant factor, again, because a tremendous amount of your lift is on all the time. So unlike an airplane where you're relying on the forward motion to give it, the fact that most of your lift is on it and you've got a very large thing, we're relatively insensitive to those sorts of things. It's notionally, the flight dynamics is a little bit of wobble. So when you see things, just because of your size and the fact that most of your lift is unaffected by the outside air stuff going on.
Thank you.
So here's the actual flight of our demonstrator, the P-791. So one of the things is its nimbleness for a relatively large system. This is activating on its air cushion landing systems. A spike takeoff takes off in this size about 20 knots. Maximum speed had a maximum speed of about 40 knots. As you get bigger, the speeds all increase. So the LMH1 is intended to take off at about the 20 knot speed at maximum loads, cruise economically at about 60 knots. Importantly, at reduced payloads, the vehicle can actually do vertical operations. So if you drop your payload weight to about 36,000 pounds, the ship is capable of direct vertical operations, similar to a helicopter, but not as precise. So it's not, don't think about it as a precision device that it's going to take off vertical, much more like a hot air balloon than as a helicopter.
Is the reason the increased size is faster because you can put bigger thrusters on it, or
you put larger thrusters, but also just the aerodynamics of it say that as you go up in size, the relative drag to your surface area is going down. And so you're able to put larger engines on it, but also push it at slightly faster speeds. So the 60 knot goes to 70 knots, goes to about 85 to 90 knots when you get up to the largest airship. So we proved ourselves that we could do this. We built a demonstrator to prove to, I'll say, others that have come to it. So why has this been so hard to make happen? And I think that Nick was going to address that a little bit if he calls in. But it's been a long and hard journey, because it is entailed a fairly sophisticated value stream. And so let me kind of walk through that for a second here. When you look across this, this is what we call the value stream. And in studying business areas, innovations and revolutions happen when everybody recognizes that they've got a piece of the value stream that makes good sense for you. And so if I start on the far left, Oil and gas, we've been able to convince them for quite a while that, oh, wouldn't this be great if you had year-round access without infrastructure at low cost? That'd be a great thing. But they're all from the state of Missouri, and so they all want us to show them that. And so they've been reluctant to sign on to do that. Mining, very similar to the oil and gas side of this. Wanting to say, okay, I believe it, but I don't operate most of my transportation assets. I actually work through logistics companies, and so the next side would be logistic providers. I can say publicly that we've got an Alaska logistics company, Pacific Rim Logistics, that have come on board as a logistics agent for Straight Line Aviation, another transportation provider to the far side there, that are starting to do the detailed planning for, okay, logistically, how do I do this? How do I set up the operation specifically, whether they be transportation or the other components of that that allow you to do it? So you need to have the logistics side being able to understand, can I make money doing that? And then where we thought it'd be easy is just take it to the airlines and sell them airships. And they say, well, I'm not buying airships until I know I've got contracts, mm-hmm. logistic providers from oil and gas companies or mining companies to do it. So you have to drive it all the way through that user chain. And then if I get to the financing side, and I'll put Lockheed Martin in a moment into the financing mode that says, so why would I put all my capital outlay to do something that I don't know if anybody's going to buy it or anybody's going to use it? And so it became, I have to simultaneously satisfy all the elements of that value chain before the revolution can happen. And so what I'm going to show you here in a minute is the fact that I think we've gotten to the point where we've been able to satisfy all the elements of that, and we're closing that entire value chain to bring revolutionary technology and revolutionary approaches to a new frontier. So one of the early ways that we started is in the oil and gas. One of the natural things is capitalizing on the additional range and payload that allows you to think about different offshore areas, because all the, as we talked to the oil companies, all the easy ones have been found, and they don't have really transportation solutions to go out to the farther reaches. But you start becoming beyond where the helicopters are able to operate. And so the airship has an inherent ability to operate at greater ranges. And at greater payloads, and generally safer in terms of the transit, but there are challenges when you get close to the actual operations, close to the offshore rigs. And so the ideal situation that we've looked at would be, do you want to land the vehicle vertically, directly on the rig? I can tell you that the heliport would be about a 500-foot diameter heliport, and so it's not an insignificant landing zone that would be required. And last time I looked at most of the rigs, they have pointy things and fire and all sorts of things that are generally not a very friendly environment for airships to operate on. So the other thing, so that would be one concept. The other would be for a transfer process that said, you know, you could land on a heliport that's perhaps on the surface of the water, and then do the transfer of personnel. But that's not without some risk in terms of moving people from the water level, if you will, onto the rig level. So we do not advertise that it's an ideal solution for the maritime problem right now in terms of other ways of doing it, but we've certainly looked at it. And depending on the region, there are some regions where offshore is a little bit easier, that you could think of an ice-locked thing as being a fairly easy way to do it, because you'd have the ability to land without all the dangers that are inherently there. In terms of broader energy support, we look at being able to support across all the phases. From the exploration phase, one of the things that's interesting about the airship is it can fly very slow, and in fact it can persist at really long times the slower you go. So the 60 knot speed that we fly at is really because cargo doesn't want to just sit there. But if you have other missions that say, I don't care about going fast, then I can actually operate at very low speeds, whether it be all the way at 0 knots, which at smaller, at lower payloads you can fly, hover essentially, or even staying at like 20 knots where you use some of your aerodynamics. That gives you a tremendous ability to conduct surveillance and communications missions, where you think about being the communications node for an exploration team or one that's doing surveillance of the pipelines, etc. You also have the ability to do the aerial surveying, again at that low speed. The ability to carry sensitive equipment, because you've got an inherently very low vibration environment, that you've got a very large soft structure with very low power generating noise suspended. And so you could envision that you could put advanced sensors on that would allow you to map and survey broad areas. And then clearly emergency services. I know that one of our partners is looking at coming up with camp modules that would be roll-on, roll-off camp modules. So you could roll off a fully assembled camp module that would allow you to move forward in the exploration phase. If we look at the development phase, with relocation, we've worked with the oil companies to be able to say, yeah, right now they're too big, but without much work, you could actually cut the size of the rigs down and make them into smaller parts so that you could start capitalizing on the fact that you can move them much, much more affordably and set them up. And then the pipeline construction, an obvious one there, is the ability, whether it be direct pipeline support or even support to the last technical mile, if you will, where you could mass the product and then move the pipeline materials the last mile by helicopter or other means, because a lot of it's getting the stuff mostly there, and you could use the right of way as the primary means for your infrastructure going on there. In the production phase, there's not much better than a pipeline for moving stuff out, and so it's not a great thing to move oil, but in terms of a spill response, whether it be an offshore sort of thing where you could take a tremendous amount forward, or even in an ice lock sort of situation where you may be able to offset an icebreaker sort of requirements, as I got to get there quickly. And so we see some things in the production phase.
Representative Johnson.
I'm just back to your surveillance and communication. Do you see it being used sort of as a Wi-Fi node for communication?
It could be. So we have had some. One of the features of an airship is they're radio frequency transparent. So you can put the modem, if you will, that would allow you to have satellite connectivity without any interference. It's quite a trick on the airliners to actually put Wi-Fi into the airliners, but for ours it's a fairly simple thing. So yeah, you could serve as a cell tower, as a thing. A lot would depend on how long you would plan to stay in the air. That I can tell you that we had one customer that was interested in going all the way around the world unrefueled with one of these, and the answer is yes, you can do that. It just takes you about 28 days to go around the world. So we have done studies that say we can stay in the air for up to 28 days, including enough creature comforts to make it all the way around the world. But yes, you could use it as, if you will, an elevated cell tower sort of thing. Economics, that's ultimately trying to drive at affordable solutions. So here I'm going to pick a little bit on heavy lift helicopters. You've got at least twice the range of the most capable helicopters. And I'll say that's an economical range. We have a range of up to 1,400 nautical miles, but generally that's only looked at as a mission where you would be ferrying it. Typically, you would look at ranges that typically go from about 300 to 500 nautical miles, which are at the absolute extremes of where the helicopters are operating. Payload capacities, the most capable helicopter right now is retired Russian hardware, Mi-26s. Those are very capable but very expensive helicopters to operate. Most of the others were at like four times the payload capacity of those. And then importantly, because ultimately it's crew and fuel and maintenance that drive direct operating costs, well, I hate to say it, but helicopters are designed to almost beat themselves to death. And the fuel that's required to do that, because it's all provided direct lift, gives you the ability to drop the cost, your direct operating costs, dramatically, which the user likes because they can go out and still charge helicopter sorts of rates but make higher margins. So that's part of that value chain that allows them to say, I can still make a lot of money at this, which is why I'm willing to take the risk in doing this. We're excited. We've actually... In the public press, there is a Canadian outfit called Quest Rare Earth Minerals that has signed a memorandum of agreement with Straightline Aviation, a UK company that has signed a letter of intent to purchase up to 12 of our airships. I'll say that's very serious stuff going on right now, and Quest is in the middle of replanning their mine, which is in northeastern Canada, for rare earth minerals, to actually stop the current plans, which was to build from Strange Lake project, which is in the center of the graph there, right between Labrador and Quebec, a road that went east to the port, move it across some very challenging real estate and lots of rivers and stuff like that, put on a barge and then barge it down into the lower regions. They have made a commitment and signed an MOU worth $850 million over the next 10 years to move all of their concentrate by airship, 20 tons at a time. They're very excited and believe that before the full 10 years that we will have the next size up, which is the 90 ton, which becomes even more economical for them to do. So they are very interested in that. That's a mining example, but there's also some stuff going on from an energy standpoint that they're looking at putting in large wind farms in that vicinity. And so one of the things that We've been studying with Siemens over in Belgium, his ability to actually carry large wind turbine blades. One of the advantages of our ships is we can leave the tailgate up, and so we can actually stick the cargo out the back. So
down.
No, it's actually up. We say down, but we actually put the tailgate up. And so the large turbine blades that are longer than 60 feet long actually stick out the back, but that doesn't influence our ability to do it. So we're very excited about those sorts of applications as they think about the challenge of putting those wind turbines in areas that are generally without a lot of infrastructure right now. Another example is direct operating costs. This is an operation up on the North Slope looking at actuals that said in my yearly transportation model for part of my operation, and I can't give the actual data because it is proprietary to the one that we're looking at, but the combination of things that they use to support the operations at Point Thompson, flying people from Anchorage to Point Thompson, we're not a great people flyer because we fly at relatively low speeds. We can do it, but generally the workers want to get there at airplane speeds. And also, it's hard to compete with the road, with the Dalton Highway, so most of the stuff that goes to Dead Horse, although we start to get somewhat competitive with that in the winter season, it's still kind of hard to beat any land mode in terms of that. But if you look at the hardest part of it, which is that last mile, if you will, from Point Thompson to Dead Horse, we do start to compete very well. We were actually able to show that we were able to come up with a 25% reduction in the transportation cost in doing that, which one of the things that does is de-risks things, because a lot of our operators that are out there look at it as going, I'm not ready to bet on it yet, but I like to know that at least when it does start to materialize, that I can realize the fact that I see cost reductions and everybody is advantaged by that. Another significant test case that we did was a large operation. This happens to be in Papua New Guinea, where one of the things that we see is the ability not only to lower the transportation infrastructure costs, but actually mitigate and enable other things. This is a large liquid natural gas development in Papua New Guinea. They actually spent, I can say, close to $1 billion to put in a 10,000-foot runway and all the infrastructure to bring all the materials in, because the roads in that region were not sufficient to handle the heavy logistic load that came in, so the only option they had was to fly it in. We did an exhaustive study of the same project. If you had the 20-ton airships in the same thing, that you would have received a 98% reduction in infrastructure costs to do that. So nearly $1 billion saved in terms of what it means to bring those on board. Again, the large companies are not willing to make a bet because they don't exist, but they start to look at these, and they're starting to look at these in planning in terms of how that happens. And so things that are not capable of being done suddenly become enabled by the ability to have the hybrid airships. Direct transportation costs, once the infrastructure was there, just moving all the stuff in and out, they used the Russian Antonov 124. By using the small hybrid airship, we reduced their cost by 72%. So dramatic reductions in the cost of how you do ongoing operations. Safety. So one of the things inherent about moving slow, you're any pilots here, but you know that when the scary part is when you're getting closer and closer to having to end the flight or start the flight, that's when things are moving most quickly. One of the advantages of the hybrid airship is everything can go slow. And in fact, if you get to the point and you go, okay, I really don't like this, you can slow down and just sit there and essentially loiter without having to commit. The soft structures, redundant systems, were capable of flight with three engines. So even if you had a loss of an engine at a remote site, our system would be capable of taking off and flying back under three engines. Not something that any current aircraft systems, if you lose an engine at your outside point, you have to fly engines in to do it. We actually have enough capability to fly with only three engines. And in fact, I mentioned even if I lost all four engines, that I still have a safe situation in terms of how it comes in. We can land anywhere. Another safety feature that in the event that, as you pointed out, if I slowly get heavier and heavier, at some point you're going to look for a place to land. I can tell you one of the interesting things, the FAA was interested in where we put our life rafts for water things. And we entertained them for a while, and then we had some operators come on board and say, wait a minute, so I'm going to get in my suit, I'm going to throw this little orange raft out that door, and I'm going to jump out, or I'm going to sit here in my 300-foot-long big white thing that is floating. It can't sink. I think I'll just stay here. I don't think I'll don the life boats and stay with the ship. So we believe excellent safety features inherent with it. And despite the hydrogen thing of the Hindenburg, so since someone brought it up earlier, it's not a Hindenburg sort of thing. Sustainability is another big thing. So we have safety going. The other big piece is sustainability. And conservatively, if you look at the fuel usage, this is all flying kind of the same mission. If you look at a current helicopter, we're at 1/5, in many cases 1/10 of the fuel requirement of a helicopter sort of thing. The most efficient fixed-wing aircraft were at least 1/3 of the fuel requirement of the most efficient ways of doing that. In many cases, were again, an order of magnitude less fuel requirement than the current way of doing it. Noise. We're aware, and in many areas, that noise is becoming more of an issue, whether it be in city areas. So Europe is looking very much at the ability to fly these where they have noise restrictions currently. So even though they have the infrastructure, they can't handle the airport noise. In many of the remote areas, it's a wildlife sort of thing. So how do I mitigate the issues from an environmental impact? I can tell you that there's sufficient power on board to where you can possibly even put very efficient mufflers on this to where you can make it almost a silent operation. But to give you an idea, these are basically V8 engines, car engines that are used to turn propellers, so inherently pretty quiet. So we're in about a 60 dB range typically, which is about the environment of a restaurant. And you compare that with aircraft, which are about 8 times that loud, so inherently very quiet. And then less and less emissions. The less fuel you burn, the less emissions you put out, so conservatively you're at least 1/3 of the emissions that the current way of moving stuff is. And my last slide, ideally suited for remote operations, that's what we designed it for. The unimproved surface capability is a key element of that. Very environmentally friendly, both on the ground and in the air with the noise and what's going on. Driven by cost, driven by affordability, so all the others are benefits on top of that, but not only that, but you get very big reductions in cost. It starts to enable projects, so in many cases it's revolutionary enough to where you start thinking about projects that I previously wouldn't even entertain to go in there. And lastly, I think we're excited that we think we'll be in Alaska in 2019. We are very close to closing several deals that will actually do this. And I think the remarkable part is the fact that we've partnered with all the people in many in your state that have been doing a lot of the hard legwork to figure out how do I actually do this, whether they be at the on the energy side, the logistics side, or in the transportation side. So with that, Chairman, I'll conclude my prepared remarks.
Thank you. And I'm sure there's some more questions here. Representative Johnson?
Yes, thank you. Temperature, outside variant temperature, what effect does that have on?
Very little. It actually helps because the density goes up when the temperature goes down. We are designing for aviation limits, which are generally minus 40 degrees. As it turns out, that's FOC because they cross at that point. So that's our design point, up to 120 degrees F, so that is standard aviation specifications. We are working with others to figure out in some of the remotest operations, do they want to hangar them? In some areas, they may decide that they will put up hangars. Generally, we are designing it to live outside. Most airplanes, in fact, are designed to live outside. So most people probably don't recognize there aren't enough hangars in the world to put all of our airplanes in, just like there's not enough dry docks to put all of our ships in. So airplanes are inherently designed to live outside, and we've designed this one to do that.
A follow-up. I was just thinking as far as your engines for your propellers, do they detach easily, or do they,
So the propulsion systems are designed to replace in mass. So there is essentially a turbine engine, or not a turbine, a reciprocating piston engine.
Okay.
It runs on diesel. A gearbox, out to an angle gearbox, that runs a propeller. The design of our system is that you would take that entire thruster system off by releasing a few attachment things, take that into the shop and work on it in the nice warm shop while you brought out a replacement unit. You replace the engine, the gearbox, and the propeller all as a unit. So it would be designed to be replaced as a unit as opposed to a maintenance sort of item.
Because I again think your temperature follow-up as far as the diesel and minus 40, and you know.
So you would do operations. One of the things about airships is they're always living. They're always alive. So they're more like a ship. We never shut the ship off. So the airship is always on. So you would have environmental systems that are doing that, whether it be it got to real cold, and depending on the environment, if you wanted to run a fuel recirc that said, I want to make sure that all my fuel is staying at the right temperatures. There is anti-icing on those things that are critical, so propellers, inlets, and things like that, that you would provide anti-icing, but you don't provide anti-icing against the envelope. Because again, as I pointed out, it's not very sensitive to that. That's mostly a weight. And one of the other things is in much of the remote areas, the environment is much more desert-like than most people recognize, and there's not a lot of moisture there that is driving it, at least in the landlocked. You can get it in the maritime environments can be a little more harsh in terms of this.
Representative Westlake.
Yes, and through the chair. I'm looking at that picture, and I just came back from Barrow. This weekend it's over 14 hours of daylight, and next week it's going to be over 15 hours of daylight. And that brings to mind the as harsh as the ultraviolet light is, and you're looking at that picture there, the water, the sun reflecting, what's the service life? What's the expectancy on one of these before you have to pull it back in?
We give it a 15-year service life on the envelope. We plan, and all of our models have a replacement, envelope replacement at 15 years. That's one of the things that we're looking at. That'll be a kind of a guarantee. That'll be on Lockheed Martin, but we do believe that we've paid attention to the environments of that material.
Through the chair. Because that's the thing, is all of us in these times that we're tightening, we're just thrilled in what you're doing, but the O&M is what we really do have to be aware of. So those numbers, they're just great. So thank you for this.
Right. And those are all part of those analyses, is they're all trying to bring in all of those costs.
Thank you.
I have a couple questions. Is there any risk of losing helium pressure or whether it's through normal operation or just someone takes a shot at it, someone put a hole in the pipeline with a gun for fun. So I just, some guy duck hunting,
So we attribute it to the Texas crowd, but
Leslie's got it too.
Hope my dear watch this. We've had that question just about every time. And so airships are relatively invulnerable to small arms fire because we use very low pressure. So large areas, but very low pressure. So that if someone were to take a shot at it, you would poke two holes in the airship, one where it went in, one where it would come out. You might see the one on the lower surface and actually go, okay, I've got a leak. You would most notably see it probably after about a week where you notice, my gas mileage is going down. Because what happens is you would slowly find that you're losing a little bit of helium lift and you're having to increase the amount of aerodynamic lift. And so you would probably notice it first on your mile per gallon gauge because you would see that I'm slowly losing a little bit of my lift. It doesn't pop. It doesn't quickly flow out. And in fact, what's happening is you get air that's coming in faster than the helium's going out. And so it takes a while for you to even notice that that's going on. There are images of the aerostats that we deployed overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan, which were lighter than air and tethered. And when they would come loose, they would send gunships up to try and shoot them down. Mm-hmm. And they would literally be incapable of doing it because there's just such low pressure that they just continue to float. And so everybody asks, is it sensitive to it? The answer is no. The most sensitive thing, and is one of the things that we found out with the Goodyear operations, is because people do shoot at blimps, is that they actually put some armor on the bottom of the thing because the most important thing is that they don't hit the pilot. But an actual hole on the airship, you literally go out with duct tape and you would repair the hole. We have an innovative thing that we won an award for last year called Spider, which is an autonomous vehicle that we actually put on the inside and outside of the airship that allows it to go around and find small pinholes. Mm-hmm. It actually allows us in the manufacturing process to find those things and fix them. But we've looked at that, and our military customers are very interested in its robustness against small arm fire and other stuff. But it's not a big deal other than it's a nuisance that you think that people are actually cheating at.
Yeah. Another question is, you mentioned when you're unloading fuel, say from the extra storage tanks, and you have to upload water or take on water to keep the weight the same, 4,000 gallons or something. So let's say you're in Dean's neck of the woods and it's 30 below. you have to keep a fair amount of fresh water flowing onto the ship and then offload. No, I guess you keep the water and fly away with it. Is that right? Okay.
So our concept are heated water trucks and heated systems in, so that's not unknown to people in remote areas. So you'd simply, the ship would have the ability to keep it heated, and then you'd have the water truck on the ground would be with heated water.
And if you decided to, say, bring external fuel tank, or not use necessarily all the ones within the ship, but just say bring on a bladder, like you said, because I guess for rural Alaska, fuel delivery is an issue, especially in winter months, and obviously you can't get a million gallons, but like you said, small regular deliveries, and if it's economical, and I guess maybe that would require the next size of airship.
Actually, 20 tons of fuel is quite a bit of fuel, and so if you had a weekly delivery, even I think that you would most likely find that it's more economical, instead of having large bladders that you constantly stockpiled with, that you instead count on a regular delivery. It says, I'm just going to keep topping up the city tanks, if you will, as opposed to a bladder operation. It's more likely, I think, but I think it will depend on the specifics of any given operation.
So even with the smallest, your first one that's going to be available at 20,000 tons.
20 tons.
20 tons, yeah, 40,000 pounds.
20,000.
Yeah, sorry.
If I did that in gallons, that's probably going to be, if I had that all in fuel, I'm probably talking about almost 5,000 gallons.
Okay.
Of I'm looking water. Fuel's a little bit lighter than water, so you might be a little over 5,000 gallons.
Yeah.
Delivery every trip.
And I guess, if that can be economical compared to other modes, and I don't know if airplane is the, go ahead.
And through that certainly would be economical, because we're already doing that. There are villages now out in rural Alaska where you don't have the capacity of the village anymore. You use more fuel, you've got more people living there, and even now, we'll run out. Like this month, we're going to run out in two villages. They, even when they got their fall supply, they are now out and they've got to airlift all the fuel in. This would be much more economical.
So conceivably, this is something we could see in the next few years. I mean, if there's airships in Alaska on other capacities, maybe the logistics company can say, hey, we're going to run some fuel out to...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a small subtlety also with the onboard saddle tanks. The aircraft will be certified for fuel in those, along with passenger operations. In many operations, as soon as you bring a fuel bladder on board, it's considered a hazardous cargo, and then you're limited to only essential crew. So you can't do a combi, can't carry people and fuel under most circumstances if you have a bladder system, because it's considered a hazardous cargo at that point. We've been investigating liquid natural gas sort of transport, whether that at some point might be an option also. A little more hazardous than heavy fuels, but certainly one that we've had discussions on in terms of, is there an infrastructure that would deploy LNG in remote areas?
And is hauling people a necessary component? And in other words, can you just be like a cargo ship, similar to a current fuel hauler now, which is just hauling fuel?
Yes. So as I point out early, people ride for free nearly, and in fact, the initial operations that we will have with the FAA is they're non-revenue passengers.
Okay.
So we're not allowed to be an airline. We're not intending to be an airline operation, but if you're in a remote area and you're taking crew out, or if I presume you could come up with a non-revenue means if there are villagers or something that ride, as long as you're not charging an airline ticket price for it. Eventually, we expect that the FAA will see a safety record, which is really what they're looking for, and would allow potential operation as an airline. But frankly, it's more like operating like the bus line. There's not a lot of people that are that excited to fly at 60 knots, but if it's a relatively short thing and it can cut down on the point-to-point and the safety sorts of things, you'd see passenger operations at the couple of hour length durations.
I'm sure if you're here in Alaska and you had some non-rev seats, I bet there's some people around here that would take a ride. Any other questions from the committee? I don't see Nick online. Oh, he is? Oh, he's just not on my screen here. Okay. Well, we have Nick Mastro da Casa from DOT on the line. Nick, are you there?
supply out there.
Okay. Have you been listening to our presentation? Is there anything you'd like to add to that? It's a little garbled. I'm having a tough time, but my hearing isn't the best always. Okay. Thank you. I think we have a question, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just for anyone that can answer it, but I was wondering, as you were talking about, you know, doing your transport, say, in the Arctic from, say, Dead Horse and maybe over, maybe that was a base and you were going towards Canada with this. How hard is it to, I mean, can you fold this up like a napkin and put it in your back pocket and transport it somewhere and then pop it open and take off when you got it transported by truck, or does this have to go... So
an excellent question, but the answer is no.
Okay.
But the envelope is actually part of the structure, so it's certified as part of the structure. So a lot of people think that it deploys, we let the air out of it and put it in a truck. No, because it has to be, once it's assembled, it is structure. So the airship, once inflated, is never purposely deflated other than at the 15-year point when we would plan on an envelope change. The system is capable of ferrying at great distances. So if I were finishing operations at Dead Horse, I could deploy it to Africa. I'd stop, most likely, if I'm going to Africa, unless I decided that I wanted to put on enough additional fuel. But it is capable of going all the way around the world. So we have done a 22,000-mile mission with it, being able to do it at slow enough speeds. But as you slow down, you go further and further. So, but no, it ferries under its own power, and you never deflate it once it's inflated, because that's part of the primary structure of the vehicle.
All right. Thank you.
I have a question. Are there any, is there competition that's at about the same development point that you are, that's maybe signing contracts or about to, or has a ship ready, almost ready to go? Or are you guys in the lead? Or do you know?
I believe Lockheed Martin is in the lead on this, that our most visible competition is an outfit in the United Kingdom called Hybrid Air Vehicles. They're the ones that previously had competed and honestly beat Lockheed Martin on a contract for the U.S. Army for a surveillance airship. So it's not intended to be a cargo airship. They flew one time under the Army contract, and the Army subsequently canceled it for a variety of reasons. They were able to repurchase the vehicle, had a successful first flight and a not-so-successful second flight. So I would characterize a lot of their technology as being about where we were 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so we are mindful of competition, but we also believe in remote areas that are oftentimes... although there might be a cheap knockoff, that they rely on Caterpillar diesel and other things like that, because in remote areas the last thing you want is something that's not very reliable. And with 100 years of aviation expertise behind us, Lockheed Martin feels that we're somewhat unique in the ability to not only develop and design but support new product implementation in some of the harsher areas. We do operations, have a long history. The C-130 is a long history of a very capable and robust transport thing, tested in not only the Arctic but around the world in some of the harshest conditions. And so we believe that 100 years of aviation gives us a little bit of a leg up on our competition in terms of where we stand to be here. Quite frankly, the other challenge is self-disruption. And in many cases, the adoption of new technology is such that even if I'm an existing operator, I'm kind of not necessarily motivated to change the way I do business until somebody else forces me to do it. And that's been part of our challenge in introducing this technology, is a lot of the existing operators go, yeah, it's a great idea, but at the moment I got these other platforms and I'm willing to do it that way. And so a lot of the challenge has been that you have to get people who have a vision and an entrepreneurial spin that says, okay, because I'm not in that business, I'll go ahead and enter that business. And that makes a little more risk in the whole equation, in terms of they tend to not be the well-capitalized organizations. One of our announced buyers, the Straight Line Aviation, is a group of former airship operators, but have, you know, and amongst themselves, they're just a five-man company. Mm-hmm. And so that's been part of the challenge, and Nick is, I think, would address some of that also in terms of, you know, why this has been a little bit hard.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was just wondering, I mean, you kind of touched on the Army and the surveillance opportunities, say, but if you could, like, load up an entire, I don't know my Army terms, but a platoon or something with tanks and tents and all that, and you just deploy, I mean, is the Army or the military then involved in the development for those large-scale transport at all?
Yes, let me address. So we started with the Department of Defense because we're a defense contractor. Mm-hmm. So we spent probably at least 10 years trying to figure out how to entice the U.S. military to do this. And in the U.S. military, as you guys are probably aware, there's kind of a division between the Air Force hauls the Army around, and so the Army is very interested in exactly how the Air Force is going to do that. At the 2010 size, it carries not a significantly tactical payload. So it doesn't have as much use for hauling tanks around. Certainly as you get up to the 100-ton or all the way to the million-pound, the 500-ton thing, they start to go, okay, that's really neat stuff. That they had a concept that we called Fort to Foxhole, that you could literally avoid all the transshipments that were involved by going direct to the fort, loading up the mechanized infantry, flying them, as it turns out, not to the foxhole, because there are some vulnerabilities that are there, but you could certainly avoid the bottlenecks at the ports. That one of the things that they have is that all the stuff currently comes in by ship, and it bottlenecks at the port, so you can skip the port and go maybe foxhole back a little bit to the a little bit off what's called the forward line of battle sort of thing. And so the U.S. military has been interested, but they've not been willing to be the initial adopter because they see some limitations on it. One of the things I would like to highlight that the U.S. military and others are very interested in from a civil mission is its ability to manage humanitarian operations. That when you look at something like Haiti, and this was something we studied extensively with U.S. Transportation Command, was the ability of the fact that the ports were plugged and there was no way for the airplanes to come in, that you can envision that this can operate in a soccer stadium. And so when the infrastructure's gone, you can immediately bring it in. And so we're very excited about that as a mechanism that the U.S. military has said, well, we would likely craft that fleet in times of emergency to be able to use it to operate when the infrastructure is down. Likewise, we did some detailed looks at Fukushima and what happened there when you have a tsunami that goes in and wipes out all the infrastructure. That could you have brought that in? The answer is yes. We're also very excited that one of the other things that is publicly out there is the fact that there is an international organization known as RADAID that is trying to bring radiological support to underdeveloped areas where you have very sensitive radiological equipment that currently tries to travel overland by truck, which is not a very environmentally safe way to move delicate equipment, or even by air, because you tend to have the high landing load. So an organization in the U.S. called RADAID is very interested and has actually signed up to create medical airships. And so it's not just about the extraction of oil and minerals and all the other stuff, but there's some very interesting humanitarian things that Lockheed Martin is excited about supporting, the least of which is when the infrastructure gets knocked down. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think that concludes our presentation, but thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. It's very informative, very interesting, and we will see you around the building and other committees, and then our not lunch and learn here in about 15 minutes.
Excuse me, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Is it a not lunch and learn because there's no food?
No, we will have nourishment. There's a
I'll adjourn here. It's 11:45. We will meet on Thursday. We'll be hearing some legislation from Representative Tuck, a resolution on renewable energy. That's on Thursday, and I will adjourn this meeting at 11:45.